Hey, everybody, welcome to the Green Room. We're here on Disrupt TV. We're episode number 361. We're going to quickly introduce our guests in reverse order. So, Maisie, where are you coming in from?
Santa Cruz, California.
What are we talking about today?
About my new book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime.
Oh, God, we have it up already. Ah, very, very cool. Welcome. So, all right. Eric, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about today?
Hey, I'm based in Seattle, Washington, and we're going to be talking a bit about some of the disruptive trends in the retail industry, specifically how data enablement and AI are creating opportunity in that vertical.
Tremendous. And then, of course, Kunal, where are you coming in from? And it looks dark over there. What's going on?
Yeah, somehow it's dark. No, I'm from California. My name is Kunal Agarwal, but I'm currently in Bombay. So, you know, we're excited to be worldwide on the number one show, Disrupt TV.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for being on the show. It's amazing. And of course, I'm here with my special co-host today, Holger Mueller, of course, with Constellation Research. And of course, our producer, Elle, is off today. So, but with that, we're going to kick off the show and we will see you very soon. So see you on the other side. Here we go. Welcome. We're here live on Disrupt TV. Got my awesome co-host today, Holger Mueller, who is standing in for Bala Afshar. And of course, many of you know him from his work as covering enterprise acceleration platforms, infinite computing, anything infinite has his name next to it. And of course, he's been everywhere covering anything from HCM to the future of technology and apps and platforms. And of course, understanding where the I'd say probably the product ecosystem, developer ecosystem is headed, and more importantly, where next-gen apps are going to be. So welcome to the show, Holger.
Thank you, Ray. Great to be here with you, the man who needs no introduction. I don't have a cheat sheet, but you know Ray from everywhere. So we're so happy to have you here, Kunal, coming in live from across the world from us. We're on the West Coast, and you're where?
Well, I'm in Bombay right now, but I do live in the West Coast. So, you know, hopefully,
We're just testing. We're just testing because Ray said infinite connectivity. We take it for granted. We are in Bombay and we're on the West Coast and we think we can stream this live. So let's talk about your startup, Kunal, which is...
Yeah. Let me introduce Kunal first, right? And Kunal is the founder of Dope Security, the Fly Direct Secure Web Gateway. If people haven't found that out. Prior to that, he led product management at Forcepoint and, of course, consisting of an insider threat, CASB endpoint. And before that, he led the IoT and data center security portfolio at Symantec, system hardening and zero-day mitigation endpoint, USB scanning station, and network anomaly detection for industrial in-vehicle applications. And before that, he was a PM for IAM information protection, DLP encryption identity, and CASB. But of course, it's important. He's a security guy. He's been doing it for over 15 years, from credit card security, I want to know about ethical hacking and security research, of course, at Cal. So a little fun Cal Stanford rivalry, as we always say in the Bay Area, always very, very fun. None of us went to Stanford, so you're good here. So, but with that, welcome to the show. So all yours, Holger.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, forgot about the intro, but very impressive, Kunal. I am not a security guy, so pardon my ignorance in any of my questions and comments here, right? But I heard about SWGs when I had less gray hair. How does a technology which has been around 20 plus years ago, even 25 years ago, can make a comeback here in 2024 in the age of AI? Fill us in here.
So cyber is so interesting, right? So first off, there's like a set of technologies that every single company uses, every single company. And like even today, you can imagine what they are, right? If you have 1,000 laptops in your company, you're going to have some way of managing them. You're going to have some way of making sure there's no malware on them. And then like last but not least, you need to make sure that, hey, let's make sure that they can't just access anything on the internet, right? I'm sure you can imagine. If you have a bunch of people in the company, you may not want them accessing malicious websites, maybe piracy websites, or maybe you don't want them watching Pornhub. How do you do that? And that's the purpose of this technology. And for us in cyber, you know, there's a lot of people that create new things. But then there's folks like myself that I believe in the kind of capabilities of making something better, right? It's not necessarily about just completely replacing it. It's all about upgrading it. And that's the purpose of Dope Security.
Wow. Okay. So these secure web gateways are back, is what you're saying. And they're showing up in a different format.
We're trying to make them a little more dope. But the idea is that right now, if you're a company of all shapes and sizes, we have customers that are in the Fortune 100 that have tens of thousands of employees, if not hundreds of thousands. But then we also have some folks that have 50 people. And they're like, look, I want to make sure that somebody's not accessing anything, just anything on the internet. Or I want to make sure they're not accessing their personal Gmail account on their work laptop. You can imagine that's pretty important for some people. These kinds of things are what you can accomplish with a web filter or a web gateway, right? It's like, hey, how do I control the unlimited access that you might have to the internet? And it's kind of cool, right? You click one button, it blocks your Dropbox. Or you click one button and a lot of people use corporate Gmail, right? But then your personal Gmail doesn't work at all, or you can't upload files there, things like that. So it's really nice and very different. And that's why I like to explain it. It's like it's really like parental controls for your employees.
Well, some of the problems with like SWGs in the past, right, is people couldn't really, like, they would break or like things would slow down. And, you know, you'd actually have like a lot of, you know, like, I'd say like outages, right, that were going on and performance issues that were popping up because they actually were built on top of data centers. What are you doing differently to avoid that?
So cybersecurity is interesting, right? It's been around for a long time and it helps a lot of companies. But the focus on the user experience is not that great. And if you think about it, like both of all three of us on the call, right? If we take outside of the context of, oh, I want to be secure, how much are you going to give up to be secure, right? Is it an extra two-factor authentication, for example? It's not that much work. But is like your internet speed by like 5 times, 10 times, like, or not even having internet at all sometimes? And so there's like a level. It's like, what's in it for the end user? And that's what, for me, is so important, is how much can we help the end customer and make their life better. And so for us, architecturally, right, these products have existed for 2 decades. And the way they work is that there was a box, like literally a physical appliance sitting in your data center your office. It's in your office. And then that office box, people said, well, it's kind of annoying to keep installing it in every single office around the world. So what if we just put it in this hosted model where we put it in a data center for you and then sell it to you as a service, box as a service? And what we said is like, well, let's just get rid of the box entirely. There is no more box. So instead, you have some software on your laptop and your box goes away and your internet actually travels the same way it should be. Is that you go from your laptop to a website you're trying to access rather than going through the box, whether that's in your office or it could be inside of a data center. And that's the idea.
Great. I mean, you made it boxless. And I was going to ask you, I like that you keep a concept which was necessary, which is still necessary today, but then you augmented with the technology progress. So I was going to ask you, like, what have you done doing this in 2021, 22, 23, 24? And what will change with the technology progress we see from the cloud, from AI, whatever you see? How do you make it not your grandfather's SWG anymore?
So the grandfather's SWG in my world is really about user experience. So dope means 3 things in my world: passion, UX, and attention to detail. And you'd be surprised, right? Like, one of my friends, he works at Robinhood. And, you know, he just joined the company a couple months ago. And he started staying in my house. And he's like, can you, like, please upgrade your internet speed? It's so slow. And I was like, it's not slow. I have 400 megabits per second. And he's like, no, it's slow. Look, it's only 100. And then I'm, like, downloading some stuff and it's super slow. And I was like, why are you using Zscaler? Which is one of our companies. It's like, well, of course it's slow because you're going through a data center. You're going through a stopover midpoint to access literally anything on the internet. It's like, let me ask you two, you know, if you were flying from San Francisco to LA, would you stop over in New York for a security check? Like, why would you do that?
TSA might want to do that, but okay, don't mention this. Yeah.
Like, okay, I'm going from London to Dublin in Ireland. I'm going to stop in Frankfurt in Germany for a security check. No, I would never do that. But that's the way the world works today. If you went to any company out there, there is a guarantee I can give it to you in signature, in writing. You will not be going directly to the website. It's just not the way it works. No. You go through the data center. You go through there first, and then you get to the website, which doesn't make sense. So we say, very simply, what if we could help you fly direct?
Don't stop. I learned that the hard way in my honeymoon. I had a direct flight from San Francisco to Rio de Janeiro, which flew to Miami, 3 hours layover, to Sao Paulo, 8 hour layover, and then was in Rio. So direct in the airline terminologies from the old days, it's the same equipment. The people might be changing, and you keep the same seat. So you want to do nonstop, Kunal. Nonstop.
Correct. Not direct. But so much of this, I mean, even the jacket I'm wearing, it says I am Dopes here. There's a beautiful back to it. The idea is that, like, cybersecurity doesn't have to be so stodgy. It can be a little different, but it can also be classic. Classic in the sense integrity, the ability of honesty, right? How do I show you what we're doing without talking this huge, massive buzzwords, right? A lot of the people that are listening in and talking about this, they may not know cybersecurity that well. But if I can show them, like, look, this is what we do. If I go to the piratebay.org, which is a, you know, if you know piracy, it's a very big piracy website. It won't work on my laptop. But it's nice because I'm on a personal hotspot right now. And it's great because I'll just get blocked. Yeah. But I don't have to send my internet traffic to a new country in order for this whole thing to work properly.
Talking about the buzzwords, right, which are galore, especially in cybersecurity space, right? Why do people use SSE, SASE, or SASE, I always like to connect the words if it makes sense, Malwise, and SWG, like in a kind of like convolutionary, confusing way. What is your take on that as an expert?
You know, it's wild, right? Because there's so many people out there that actually do understand this stuff. Like, I think it was like before yesterday, Gartner released the new SSE Magic Quadrant. But what's so great about someone like a Gartner is that they do research and they write out, what do they mean by this? Hi there, you should have a forward proxy. Hi there, you should have some sort of like connection to a cloud application like Google or 365 to help secure them. Oh, and by the way, you should be able to provide access to some application sitting behind the firewall. That's really it. And those capabilities have three names that are classically recognized. Secure Web Gateway, CASB, Cloud Access Security, or CASB people call it, and then some sort of a new age VPN. That's it. So it's three products. It's a trilogy of products. And that's really what it is. But in cyber, for some reason, people just say, hey, let's make a new buzzword, which may or may not work. People like it. I don't mind it because I think it helps us understand what we're talking about. But sometimes it can become a little confusing.
Well, you mentioned the biggest culprit there, right? It's an analyst company that you mentioned before, which I've never heard before, but I think they're the biggest acronym creators in the industry, right? So, but I think acronyms are good to a certain point, but they create a lot of confusion. You're absolutely right.
Well, for what it's worth, right? That paper was pretty good. It's a 20-page paper. I just read it day before yesterday. It's not bad, but it's nice to know that, like, what do we colloquially mean by that? And that's why I like to look at it as, okay, you're doing a parental controls for your employees, for example, because people can understand that. Or for example, like a new product we have coming out soon helps you tackle the problem of, hey, I'm using Google Drive or 365. What files have been publicly shared that I completely forgot about? Right? It's very simple stuff, but how do you explain that to someone? And that's what Dope has to do, right? As a company, we just want to make this easy to understand.
All right, let's flip back. So, hey, actually flipping it back real quick. So somewhere around the way, got a Series A from Google Ventures, and I think Sanjing actually funded that puppy. What did he see in this? Because Google security software, especially on the Google Cloud side, is ramping up. Were you at Google Next as well? So
I didn't go to Google Next because, I mean, it's not really like the right playground for someone like myself. But Sanjing and I, like, he's a good friend of mine. I like to think of him as a little brother sometimes and sometimes an older brother. And sometimes maybe I'm his older brother. But the important thing is that me and him met maybe 30 times before Google finally ended up investing. So from his side, he was like, look, I understand this. No one's ever really told me that UX is a focus in cybersecurity. And to be honest, if both of you looked at a UX for a cybersecurity product, it leaves a lot to be desired. And so for Dope, it was really about, look, if you're walking into a Louis Vuitton store, what does that mean to you? If you're walking to an Hermes, what does that mean to you? And so that concept of fashion meets cybersecurity, Sanjing really liked a lot. And there's technology to back it, right? Like I told you, we have Fortune 100 companies using this technology today. But it's not just about the name. It's about what's behind it. And the name for me means a lot because I'm from the Bay Area, born and raised, right? And we say dope every 5 minutes. And so we say dope every 5 minutes. It's really cool to go to India and speak to essentially the equivalent of the IRS, for example. And they say, oh, yeah, the dope agent is helping protect us. That's really cool.
So here's the name of the company.
It means a lot, right? And every single person at Dope, really, we have something to prove to ourselves. We worked at these big companies, Forcepoint, Symantec. Some of us came from Netskope or Descaler or so on and so forth. We worked at these bigger companies that are our competitors now. But the problem was that passion was missing. And this is a home for people that really care about building the best possible thing. And when we put our signature on something, that you know that dope signature means a lot.
Got it.
So, how does everybody talks about AI these days, right? How, in your view, is AI changing security in general, and maybe the SWG work that you guys are doing specifically? How is it relevant for dope?
Well, speaking of UX, right? I mean, imagine you're a cybersecurity company, the UX doesn't look great. Honestly, like, cybersecurity is also really good at taking these new age technologies. And rather than using off-the-shelf stuff, they say, hey, we've built all this AI stuff. But there's a lot of ML and AI in just detecting malware and so on and so forth. But the biggest, I would say, problem that we've seen in cyber is that people take a search box or a chat box and say, hey, let me use a large language model to go in and make a query easier to write. But these people are so technical, right? Imagine if you're talking to me, right? I go in my terminal, I say ls space minus l. I'm not going to type, please tell me all of the files in this directory. I'm not going to say that. The people are very technical. And you have to understand what's their point of view. But there's things that can be improved, right? And so the sneak preview for you two, because I really appreciate you all having me on, is that we have a capability that's coming out at the end of this month. And what it does is it allows you to understand the data that is sitting in your Google Drive or your OneDrive, right? If you have that and it's public, how do you know it's public? But also, how do you know what it is? And for the longest time, people have depended on a pattern match, like a 16-digit number equals a credit card number. But I think we can all agree, like, a 16-digit number doesn't necessarily mean that it's a credit card number, right? So imagine, I think we've all used ChatGPT. Imagine if you use the power of a GPT to understand a document and do data loss prevention. That would be incredible. That would be dope.
It would be dope. Well, hey, real quick. Tips at Black Hat, things not to do. It's coming up soon.
Black Hat. Well, RSA and Black Hat, I mean, if somebody's attending, depends on the person, right? If you're just trying to learn, you should go everywhere, right? You're just trying to learn. But if you're trying to, like, be a founder or sell, it's a little different, right? You know, going in and just having like a booth or a conference room or whatever, it's not going to help. You kind of have to get out there and you kind of have to pre-set up meetings. So it's more of a meeting ground than a true conference.
Well, I always wondered why you guys don't go to these events and just do some fun ethical hacking on everyone else. That would be fun. That would be like a dope marketing program, right?
No, they do it. They definitely do it. I got to give credit where
I know they do. But why don't you guys?
But the thing is that there's, So cybersecurity is a mixture of business people, like people that build products, people that make services. And yes, there are the actual true red team, like let's call them ethical or non-ethical hackers. We can claim that I used to be one of those. I almost went to jail for hacking when I was a little kid.
I heard about that. Yeah, I was going to say best hack ever. But
but if you think about it, that's not what I do now. And we are in the business of helping companies help secure themselves, which is very, very different than us, you know, just going in and attacking Snapchat, for example. So there's a big difference there. And I think that for me, at least, we're really big believers in just being real and being honest with who we are and trying to do the best thing for the people.
Well, it's wonderful. Kunal, thank you so much for being here, coming in from Mumbai. Kunal Agarwal, CEO of Dope Security, technically from the Bay Area, but here in Bombay. So I'm called on Twitter and X at I'm Kunal A. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Take care. I'll see you in California. Yeah? Take care.
Take care.
See you, Mountain Dew.
Bye.
All right. So yeah, very, very cool. We hit cybersecurity. We're going to hit other areas.
I need to dust off my box and see how it can be solved.
He's got a good point, right? He's going fly direct. You're going to tell him to go nonstop. So, we're going to switch to the topic of commerce. And, we'll talk about what's going to happen in the world of commerce and what's actually. Oh, we got Eric here. So, very, very
good. Hey, guys.
So, yeah, Eric, welcome. I'll do my normal introduction, get you on, and of course, we'll go from there. But more importantly, I think, as we see security, see retail, we see other things come into play, we're going to see some interesting things that come there. So Eric is the co-founder and CEO of Sound Commerce, and of course, a data platform company that basically helps brands deliver world-class, profitable retail shopping experiences. So he's got over 25 years experience as an entrepreneur and executive. And of course, he's featured leader in consumer direct and retail commerce and SaaS, cloud integration, digital currency, and digital advertising. And of course, he's been growing companies and guiding companies and their teams to shareholder liquidity. Congratulations. And of course, there's been a lot of great exits to companies like Amazon.com, Liberty Interactive. And of course, he's been doing a lot of different things across the board in terms of getting public offerings out, board directorships. But more importantly, he's now he's new ventures, this founding of Sound Commerce. And of course, this is really where we're going to spend some time talking about what's new, what's happening, and of course, some of the trends that are going on in commerce. So Eric Best, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, glad to be here.
Welcome, Eric. It's great to have a specialist, a veteran of the e-commerce industry on board. And I have to go off script right away and ask you, can you be even successful in e-commerce without having a competitive intelligence company putting products on your competitor websites due to recent events, what we heard all in the press, right? Do you have to be curious?
Yeah, it is one of the most challenging business models out there. And having dabbled in biotechnology and some other areas before I kind of set my path in this industry, I can say the complexity is high and it appears to be increasing. Coming into the show today and to this conversation, I was thinking about some of the disruptive trends that are happening in our industry right now. And it seems like there's two big ones. One is super obvious. Maybe both are super obvious. But the first is that, of course, we're seeing this return to shopping in person and shopping as a social community activity. And that has implications for direct-to-consumer pure play brands that were very successful during the COVID pandemic, of course. And the other trend is the cost of capital increasing. Oh, and you guys have seen any of the analysis of how the direct-to-consumer model works, you know that there are high variable costs on the front end to acquire a customer through some combination of Facebook and TikTok and Instagram and Google. And on the other end, there are very high costs associated with doorstep delivery. And we often joke internally that like there are 1,000 things to consider in digital retailing, and you're successful if all 1,000 go perfectly correct, and you fail if any one of them goes wrong. And so we're here to try to make life a little bit easier for the industry.
You know, it's a good point there. I mean, the 5% capital actually, 5% interest rates changed the complete environment in terms of where investments made. One of the things that we've been seeing are a couple of things: AI arbitrage, margin compression, and of course, a lot of efficiency that's been pushed out. Those three things are actually changing the landscape. Does that mean we're going to have more competitors or less competitors? Is it easier to get started in a category or is it harder? Where do you see that?
Yeah, I think it's super easy to get started. The barriers to entry are almost zero at this point. And that's because of platform providers like Shopify and, of course, marketplace platform providers like Amazon and Walmart, but more recently, Shein and Temu. If you guys saw the Temu ads on the Super Bowl, you know that they're making a big bid into the US market. So getting started is very easy. Anyone can throw up a shingle. Scaling the business in an era when you require profitable growth to grow is proving to be exceedingly difficult. And we are seeing this swing of the pendulum from favoring the direct-to-consumer model and the creation of new consumer brands like Casper and Warby Parker and Dollar Shave Club, all of these original direct-to-consumer innovators and the brands that followed them, back to an omni-channel kind of wholesale and marketplace first strategy. And I think it's just because the market is proving that these are very difficult businesses to operate.
Are there specific areas which you see, Eric, where the scaling struggles with? Is it logistics, product availability, pricing, legal compliance? Where do you see like the people who put the shingle out now being wildly successful? Where do we see them struggling?
Yeah, I think I could answer the question by talking a little bit about the trade-off between following that direct-to-consumer model versus, you know, standing up a business on the backs of an established marketplace. If you're an Amazon seller, much of the complexity of the business model is taken on by that partner, right? They figure out how to promote your product successfully in front of their audience, right? Their captive customer base. They have programs like Prime that make it more cost-effective for shoppers to buy little things more often, right? The trade-off there when you're selling through these marketplace channels is that ownership of the customer experience, and even the data, which arguably is a really important asset when it comes to the market cap or, you know, enterprise value of these consumer brands, you cede all of that to the partner. And, so if brands are capable of taking on all of that operational and marketing complexity, as they say, you know, to the winner go the spoils, it's just exceedingly rare these days to see companies that are able to pull that off. And it usually involves some business model characteristic that is aligned with direct-to-consumer success. That could be the uniqueness of the product offering. It could be a subscription replenishment model, which works very well in D2C, but you need to have something differentiated that you can hang your hat on that allows you to go direct.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense here. And you know, in digital commerce, it runs on data. We've always thought of digital as a channel, but digital is also the actually feedback loops actually happen on the data side. And so actually being successful in digital commerce today requires a lot of data, a lot of crunching of analytics and insights, and really ability to go from data decisions to get to the next best action. Talk about data platforms and how they actually fit into retail today, because a lot of retail technology was really designed as transactional systems, not really designed to handle contextual capabilities or even what we call ambient experiences. So, which is the ability to actually use context to actually drive next best action.
Yeah. Hard to talk about this without talking about Amazon a bit. You know, they have this in
Amazon.
Okay, yeah, exactly. But, you know, you think about the competitive advantage that AWS, you know, owning and operating a cloud utility computing platform offers them. And a lot of the services that you see them commercializing as public services that are available through the AWS platform began life as proprietary solutions that Amazon kept for themselves for their competitive advantage. things like predictively knowing where to move inventory across the country or across the globe based on where demand signals are strongest, right? A lot of the generative AI use cases that we see emerging now in the industry began with proprietary algorithms that were developed by Amazon or at Walmart or the biggest players within the market. You know, I think there is a much more broadly applicable story here that goes well beyond retail when we look at the rise of data as a strategic imperative and the data platforms that enable it. And in retail, it looks something like this. You know, you go to the National Retail Federation show in New York in January or Shop Talk, which just happened in March in Vegas, and there are thousands of software vendors there. But I would argue that they are starting to fall into two very different camps. You have traditional standalone SaaS providers that are solving for point use cases or solutions. But now you have this proliferation of brand new companies that are effectively building the equivalent capability, but on the backs of Snowflake or Google Cloud Platform's BigQuery data warehouse or Databricks. Yep. You know, you could almost argue that these data infrastructure providers are providing a next generation of cloud infrastructure for SaaS companies. We very much believe that at this point.
It's amazing. So
interesting. So my question, which I like, since I know I'm being here and you have you here, I need to ask is, you remember the showcase for data mining in the 90s was putting the beer next to the diapers, right? Because for the people who don't know it, the dad on the way home has to pick up some diapers because there's some newborns, right? The diaper consumption is ravenous. And he will pick up the beer, which is next to it, right? Which required the logistics to put the beer next to it, which is not all the time there. But that's a different problem. But now that we can bring all the data together, and you mentioned some of the providers, right? So how many diapers and beer moments are in the retail e-commerce data set? Because you mentioned Amazon, right, as the 800-pound gorilla. Their recommendations are not diaper and beer moments, at least for my purchasing history. It's like, oh, that makes total sense. They're very traditional, out of my purchase history. I might need this again consumption-wise. So there's some thinking. I don't want to put it down. But do you see an upside of diapers and beer moments, and how many of them are there, and are they being chased by the industry?
Yeah,
or what's
sure,
the new diapers and beer? Or what's the new diapers and beer?
Yeah. How many of them are there? I strongly believe on the enterprise side, where I'm more comfortable, I'm not a retail specialist, right? Bringing all your data together, you'll have up to 1,000 diapers and beer things because data has been so siloed across different functional areas, right? Like, oh my God, whatever, weather, you bring third-party data, weather and absenteeism, right? We always knew there was something there. We can predict it on the spot now.
Totally. Yeah. So at Sound Commerce, there's a couple of really key constructs or like call it a thesis that we're pursuing here. One is that every retail decision, and I think you could abstract this and say every business decision, has the potential to be a generative AI prediction. And we can talk about very tactical things like what beer do you put next to what diaper? We can talk about very tactical decisions like where do I allocate my next dollar of advertising budget to maximize the potential that I acquire a new customer and that I sell this product, right? There's a more strategic construct that we think this data capability enables, and it's around the concept of customer lifetime value. Amazon for many years has had this concept of DSI, what they call downstream impact. And it's the idea that if you can get a customer to sign up for Prime delivery, they're more likely to shop at a Whole Foods. They're more likely to consume audiobooks on Audible, right? So there's this connection of individual tactical decisions that for the most part in the past have been made in a silo, being able to tie together the results of those decisions in a way that drives a more strategic North Star for the industry. You know, profitable orders, long-term customer relationships, high customer satisfaction, those types of things.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And actually with commerce changing, and of course the economics of commerce changing, you know, we're going to see a lot of focus on the end-to-end piece and using the analytics for operational efficiency and actually identifying optimization, not just in the supply chain routing, but also in the catalog assortment, as well as in the offer management that's actually happening across orders. Definitely see that across the board. So, okay. So, hey, so is AI making data management sexy?
So AI is making data management mission critical for sure, right? If we
but is it sexy?
Yeah, so. I think it's very sexy. We're all in on data. It's very dope. It's very sound. If we were to coin a phrase, we see Google announcing they're investing $100 billion in AI algorithms, right, in the coming years, and they've earmarked those dollars. We would assert at Sound Commerce that one of the biggest barriers to adoption is not the strength of the algorithm solving for hallucinations and the like, but actually being able to tee up data that is clean, properly structured, and effectively ready for AI consumption. And I would assert that this is probably going to be one of the biggest challenges that we see across industries is the readiness, the picks and shovels work that is required, to borrow that phrase from .com and cloud computing, who's doing the heavy lifting to get the data ready in the first place? And that's very much near and dear to us. I would say that's a very sexy topic at Sound Commerce.
Got it. Very interesting. Holger, sorry. So,
I always scroll down on people's LinkedIn profiles when I prepare for this, Eric, and I found a very interesting title there. Urban Forest Steward. Tell us a little more about that. What are you doing? Planning skyscrapers and pipes between them, or what is the stewardship for?
Yeah, as a serial technology entrepreneur, I've lived in Seattle most of my life, although we've moved around a bit. But I find that whatever I can do as a hobby that gets me as far away from a laptop as possible is generally a positive. And in Seattle, and I think this is true for any urban landscape, we have challenges with things like, deforestation and ivy overgrowth, like invasive plants coming in. And so the forest stewards in the Seattle area are basically trying to maintain and expand those green spaces in the city. And it's been a fun place to go and invest some time and energy in the community in a way that is as non-digital as it comes.
Very good. How many trees have you planted this year?
None, but I've cleared many of them. Okay. There's something in the space called a life ring, where you're basically like ripping invasive plants off of the trunks of these trees to give them a greater chance of survival. So maybe I'm doing that in the forest on the weekends, and I'm doing it for our customers at Sound Commerce during the
week. See, there's a connection. Eric, best to save of your e-commerce and of your forest.
All we need are you to build pollinator pathways along the way, and we'll be good too. So
there you go.
You get your ecosystem on the forest on the back end. So let's talk about the startup environment, especially in Seattle, right? It's great getting startup guests here, like, Kunal, Bay Area, very established. Seattle also very established. What's the sentiment? What's the mood like? Are the Madronas and the M14s and M16s and actually M15s? I can't forget the name.
Yep.
M13?
M13, yeah. Yep.
M13, Madronas, all the other folks. I mean, are they still active? Is it still a hot environment? Are people moving out because of the new tax escrow laws in Seattle? Like, what's in Washington? What's going on? So,
yeah, I would say things have certainly changed. For our part, we are backed by both Seattle venture companies like Voyager, as well as Bay Area firms like Defy.VC and Emergence, which has been super active in some really interesting companies over the years. And we raised our last round in 2021. We're starting to contemplate when our next round of financing will come in. And we are focused pretty much on one thing, and that's our fundamentals, our financial fundamentals as a company, the ability to show that we can grow, that we've proven product market fit. And I think for high quality companies that are in that position, the markets are open and willing to write checks. I think the counterpoint to that is that a lot of the businesses that were speculative and early stage that were funded, or maybe even later stage and still speculative, were being funded a few years ago. It's much harder to see capitalization for those businesses today. So we're hopeful that we're hitting the right SaaS metrics at this moment in time, so that we fit into the upper quartile or upper decile, and we're, you know, one of the rare companies that is.
Well, we moved to rule. Are we rule of 60 now, or was it like how we go from rule 40 to rule 60? Like I'm totally like lost.
Yeah. So. And things, but again, like things will come back around. And I saw an interesting headline that you guys may have seen as well, that there are hundreds of billions of dollars moving out of the public markets right now, the public stock market, on the part of large institutional investors, and back into private equity, as well as the bond market. Because the assertion is that a lot of the upside potential within the public markets has run its course. And so who knows, maybe we'll see sort of like this larger and larger war chest of capital getting deployed and put to use again in growth stage companies.
There's quadrillion sitting on the sidelines. It's been pretty brutal for a lot of startup founders. So yeah. Well, hey, 33 million in, you know, ready for the next round. So very, very cool. So real quick, last question.
Sure.
Your co-founder, how'd you guys meet?
It's a great story, actually. So Jared, who is currently based in Boston, was moving to Seattle at the beginning of our respective careers. And he and I met on a consulting project on the Microsoft campus. And we actually helped, among other things, launch, I'm gonna say this out loud and then I'm gonna age myself, Windows 95.
When did that launch? I'm kidding.
But exactly. But more importantly, we helped with the launch of Microsoft's early e-commerce platform. And that sort of led to this, you know, career in and around Amazon. In fact, that company that Jared and I co-founded early in our career was acquired by Amazon. That's how we ended up at Amazon. And that's kind of how, you know.
I remember the partnership with SAP, because everybody thought we need to have Windows specialists to run these e-commerce things on PCs.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
So Jared and I, we got the band back together, you know, more recently, and it's been fun to reconnect with someone that I've known as long as I've known Jared and worked together. Funny anecdote, when we joined Amazon, the public stock price, they were public at the time, was $66. And when I left a couple years later, the stock was at six. And everybody in my network was advising me to get out as fast as I could. You know, eBay and buy.com and all of these other e-commerce companies were failing. So the prevailing advice from everyone I knew was leave Amazon as quickly as you can. And of course, it goes to show you what the advice is worth.
Yeah, don't trust analysts. I'm just kidding. We're here with Eric Best, co-founder and CEO of Sound Commerce, and of course, sharing us with insights on the retail side and the startup scene in Seattle. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Peter.
Very, very cool. Wow. Startup scenes from different parts, different things. We're going to switch the topic a little bit, and we're going to bring on Maisie. Maisie, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Interesting conversation so far.
Yeah, no.
We have mentioned up your switch hitter to close, Maisie. So no pressure.
Yeah, well, no, it's important as we look at different trends across different industries and across where people are going. You know, we always try to bring on the best, and of course, you know, what better than talking about Chief Strategy and Brand Officer Bon Appetit, the management company, and of course, your new book, You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime, and other lessons from the food industry for creating a more sustainable company. Maisie Gansler is Chief Strategy and Brand Officer at Bon Appetit Management Company, which serves restaurants, corporations, universities, and museums. It's a subsidiary of the largest food service company in the world, Compass Group. And over the last three decades, how's 3 decades? You don't look like it's been here 3 decades. She's helped grow the company to more than $1.7 billion in revenue and become the gold standard for sustainability and get recognition from prestigious organizations like the James Beard Foundation. Woohoo! I'm a foodie. She's the go-to expert on how food companies can make positive change, called upon from strategic counsel by advocacy groups, startups, and big businesses alike. And of course, making the corporate campus fun. So, along with campuses as well. So, welcome to the show. We've got Maisie Gansler. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
Great to have you, Maisie. And given that you wrote a book with a catchy title, the question is always like, how do you write your book? How much is it people prodding you, your lifetime wish, experience that you had? Like, what was the tipping point for you to say, I'm going to sit down take, I don't know how many months you can share with us or not, out of my life, out of our weekends, out of my vacations, out of my family, friends' life, to write. I don't know how many pages, I haven't looked it up, but what was the drive? What was the calling here?
I actually had a friend suggest that we write a book together. She's on the advocacy side for seafood, and we run together, and she said, we should write a book. And I was like, what will you write a book about? And she put together a table of contents, and anybody who's ever written anything knows it's much easier to edit than it is to start with a blank sheet of paper. So when I saw her table of contents, I said, nobody wants to read this book. It was very sciencey, very kind of inside baseball. I said, what people need to know is how they build a brand based on all this information. And that was my kind of aha moment. So I set up to writing a book proposal. That's how you sell a nonfiction book. And it took me about a year, since I did have a full-time job, to answer your question of weekends and a lot of procrastination. And then as soon as Harvard Business Review Press bought it, I was, you know, kicked into action. I then had a deadline. So then it was about 5 months of writing.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So it was your running friend, you said, right? Which is interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. How much did it affect your running training that you had to write a book?
You know, you are so dead on. I am best in the morning, and so I would get up at 5 o'clock and write then, which meant that I did not run. So I created a book, and I also created about an extra 10 pounds of weight gain during this process.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, now you can run again, right? From writing to book writing, right? So,
well, let's start with the genesis of this, really talking about pig farms and spraying stuff in the air. Let's start there. Talk a little bit about how that, you know, came to this conversation around sustainability and, of course, your CEO's passion as well as yours. So,
yeah. So the title of the book stems from a story, which is how I open the book, about my CEO, the founder of Bon Appetit Management Company, Fidel Baccio, being really fired up about how industrial pig farms handle manure. They have something called manure lagoons, which is just what it sounds like. The pigs do their business, thousands of pigs in one place, and capture it all. Then what are you going to do with it? Well, the state of the art in the industry was to spray it on fields, and neighboring families were having higher incidence of asthma, other lung problems, cancers, and kids couldn't go out to play. There's just this stench in the air. They are literally spraying shit in the air. And Fidel was super upset about this. And we had the nation's largest pig production company in our offices in Palo Alto, far from the stench, you know, clean Palo Alto where everything's nice and new and fresh. And he's saying, we don't want the newer lagoons used anymore. We want you to change the way you produce pork. And I was like, yeah, go on. Let's make change. Let's do it. But I was also thinking, how am I going to market this? You can't market manure at lunchtime. We sell food. Nobody wants to talk about poop. And that's really the genesis of the book of how do you make meaningful change, but also get market credit for it. We're in the for-profit business, so we want to be authentic and real and impact the environment and people in a positive way. But then we also want to drive revenues with those actions.
Yeah, no, makes a lot of sense. And my question to you is, like, you have five principles on how to actually make change that you talk in the book. I mean, is there one that people should start off with that you think are important? So,
yeah, well, so the book's broken into five lessons. And what I chose as lesson one is how to pick your battles, which issues to take on. And that may seem like an obvious thing if you want to get into sustainability, but there are so many different entree points into sustainability. Are you talking about climate change, animal welfare, about people in your supply chain. And no matter what your industry is, mine's food, but if you're in technology, you're going to have a myriad of issues to choose from conflict minerals to the people in the supply chain, to energy use, to what you're doing to local communities where your offices are. And you can't take them all on. So I think the first step, and what I chose as the first lesson, is picking the issues that speak to your brand and to your marketplace.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, scope three emissions from, cattle, it's going to be a huge issue, right? As people start looking at that, especially doing tracking. So
whether you've got a cattle ranch or you've got a server farm, you're going to have impacts, right? How are you going to deal with them?
Oh, the methanol. How is the cow lagoon called? I never heard that. I know the lagoon for the pigs, but what's the cow lake, the cow manure lake? It's still manure? I don't know. So I have to expand the vocabulary here.
But, they do capture manure, but cows are kept outside where pigs are kept inside for the most part. So it's a little bit different.
Less of a transportation issue, but still, I mean, let's not get into much of the poop here. But the interesting thing is, right, you wrote a book about how to bring out the right sustainability message, right, and how to market that successfully, right? So what kind of advice do you give to other CXOs out there in the industry who want to do more in sustainability and not just do it for the good of itself, but want to do this and talk about it, right? What's your advice there?
Well, I think once you've picked your issues, the next thing is to make sure that you've aligned all of your systems. And what I mean by that is that we often have a sustainability department or something over here, and then you've got operations over here. Are those things in sync? Are you incenting people to meet your sustainability goals, for example? Is that written into everyone's KPIs, not just the sustainability departments, but everyone throughout your company? Are you celebrating the sustainability wins in your corporate newsletters? Is soft power going to people that are in sustainability, or is soft power only going to the who's seen as the rainmakers bringing in the big deals? You know, so is your company culture really supporting your sustainability aims? If not, it's always going to be kind of window dressing or philanthropy or something that's just being done because of regulatory issues. And it's not going to give you that brand halo that you're after.
No, that's great. And a lot of the work that you've done in the past is really coming through supply chain innovations. Talk about where the supply chain plays a role in actually, you know, making this happen. Because, you know, you could theoretically talk about it, but a lot of action has to happen. And sometimes that happens with smart sourcing.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned scope three emissions, and it's kind of easy, relatively speaking, to focus on scope one and scope two, right? The things that are in your direct control. But where the majority of most companies' impacts are in that scope three. And I like to kind of extend the scope three concept to be not just around emissions, but also the water use in your supply chain, the people in your supply chain, the other impacts in the products that you are purchasing. And so that means that your supply chain is the place you should really dig in. And first, I would suggest bringing your suppliers together, meeting with them, and starting to ask a lot of questions and going to their locations. And there's a story in the book of sticking with the pork theme that I went to go see a sow farm where they've got pregnant pigs. And not only did I have to put on a hairnet and the big boots you usually do when you go into a food facility, it was so biosecure. I actually had to shower in and shower out, which meant that you cross a yellow line, you shower on the other side of the shower, they give you a jumpsuit. They also give you underwear, and as a woman, a bra you are completely clean when you are in the facility, and then you shower out in the reverse. Why did I put myself through that? Because you learn so much when you go on to the home turf of your suppliers, and you can see their innovation, you can see what they get excited about, and you can start poking around in the corners and saying, what's that, talking to people that they wouldn't necessarily bring into a meeting. you learn so much. So dig into that supply chain, even if you have to clean your underwear.
No, getting those secure, avoiding swine flu and all these areas has been a huge issue, especially for feed facilities and, trying to get rid of pathogens. So this is definitely a huge issue.
So I changed my diet recently to more than vegan, whole food, plant-based, and I see veganism on the rise, right? We talked so much on the supply chain side. I mean, you have a very good sense about the business that you do, offering catering service, kitchen cooking service, and so on. Do you see a rise in more demand from your customers saying we need to change options on our menus to more vegan food or more vegetarian food? Any trends you can share?
I definitely see an increase in what we would call plant forward. So not going all the way to vegan. There certainly is a growing, but not as quickly growing, subset of people that want to be pure and go 100% plant-based. But I think where we're seeing the most action is in this middle ground, sometimes called flexitarians or plant forward or plant rich, where people want to have more plants in their diet and less meat, but not eliminate animal products altogether.
And what does it do for your supply chain?
Well, it makes some things easier and some things harder. So one of the peccadilloes about your supply chain is that the more you buy of something, the more power you have in it. And so as we decrease our meat purchases, we actually in some way decrease our power in that conversation. It also makes distribution more difficult when you're buying smaller amounts of things. But I think that's a problem that we're very happy to take on, because for personal and planetary health, eating more vegetables is absolutely the way to go.
Well, you've been leading some very interesting programs at Bon Appetit. One of them was the Eat Local Challenge. Talk more about these kind of interesting things that you've put together that are, let's say, decades, in some fact, decades ahead of what other people have been doing in the industry. I think you had the Equitable Food Initiative too, if I remember way back. So
the Eat Local Challenge came out of a really important learning, which was that people have to be primed to take in information. So we have all this stuff we want to talk about sustainability, all this stuff about local purchasing and antibiotics use and climate change and all of this stuff. But your customers really want to get lunch, or they really want to complete their financial transaction. They're not ready to take on a bunch of information. And so what I found is that if you create an event, so the Eat Local Challenge is an event, and you tell people ahead of time, so they come into your business that day expecting to take a little more time to learn, to read, to interact in a different way, then they can hear your message. So the Eat Local Challenge was founded in 2005, and it's a day that we do a meal that's completely of ingredients within 150 miles. And when we did the first one, customers were thrilled. They said, "This is great, but you should buy locally every day." And we said, "We do. We've had a farm to fork program since 1999. So there was 6 years of us buying locally and putting little signs up in the cafes that people didn't see until we created the one big event, the party, the festival, that people can stop and really listen. And I think that's an applicable tool that can be used in lots of industries. You need to create a disruption point, right? Where people break out of their normal pattern and can take in information when you're talking about sustainability.
Very interesting. So you need to stump people to it, right? So little trickle might not get the awareness, right? Very interesting. But I have to ask, and Ray knows this, I always ask people who dare to share their background. Ray, for instance, has meticulously curated his background. He put out the white kitchen panels, put in the classic brown. I have to kudo you for the black and red closet in the back, which is my soccer team's color, so I like you already. But I'm going to pick the mask, and I think it's a bus to your left. Tell us a story
With the cigarette coming out of the mouth, that one?
Is it a cigarette? I only see one to the right of your head, and a bus, I think, on the shelves of the closet.
Oh, the bus over here. Yeah, so I love to travel, And so these are things that I've collected. The bust comes from Colombia. The mask comes from Mexico. There's plates back there from China, Vietnam, Malta, Istanbul, France, Spain. I think your home should be a reflection of the things that you care about. And I care about travel and learning about new cultures and eating. So that's what that stuff is.
And dwelling, don't forget.
Yes.
So, well, hey.
Thank you for sharing that.
So this is awesome. We're really thankful you're here. The book is available from Harvard Business Review Press. Came out April 2nd, 2024. Congratulations on getting us out here. Maisel Gansler, Chief Strategy and Brand Officer of Bon Appetit Management Company and author of You Can't Market Manure at Lunchtime and Other Lessons from the Food Industry for Creativity and More Sustainable Company. Of course, follow her work. There's decades of work here in terms of sustainability, progressive menus, and of course, really changing the food business landscape and the food market landscape. You can follow her on X or Twitter at MAISIEGREEN. Thank you for being on the show and happy Friday.
Thank you.
Well, okay. We've got a wide range of topics, a lot of different topics, you know, authors and startup founders. What a mix. Holger, what's your take? What do we see today?
Well, super interesting spectrum from cybersecurity to e-commerce to manure, right? Who would have thought about that? Sustainability, right? No, it's always a privilege to be here, moderate, learn a lot from our guests and so many different thoughts in the traditional coverage area we do. And by the way, it's almost 361, right? So you can almost watch for 1 year this great show. Only 4 episodes left to fill out the year if it's not a leap year. So congratulations to it and thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, this is great. And next week on episode 362, we've got Conrad Shah, UBI trial manager and series and co-author of Bootstrap docuseries and co-founder of Comingle, co-founder of Income to Support All Foundations and creator of the UBI calculator. We've got Scott Santens, founder and president of Income to Support All. And of course, he'll be there with Conrad. And of course, we've got Sally Elgeson, author and speaker and leadership coach. So if it's Friday, it's Disrupt TV. And of course, thanks for being on the show, Holger, with us as my co-host. And of course,
but wait for the special segment, right? It's the culinary part, which I have to do to balance it out. I asked Vala about the dampf noodle, right? I give you a choice. Do you want to have a European drink question or European sweets question?
European sweets for 500. Sweets. Let's go.
All right. So what is this?
I can't see that. Hold it up just a little bit.
Unfortunately, my virtual background is shooting here. Here we go.
And you're being Skyped in.
It's a rare chocolate from Germany.
It's a rare chocolate from Germany. Is that my only hint that I have here?
Yeah. Well, if I turn it around, you recognize the brand here.
Okay. Rare chocolate from Germany. I got the thing.
Square chocolate in Germany. Ritter Sport. Which is like a marketing branding idea to make it square, right? Otherwise, they're always lengthy like this, right? Chocolate bar. So it's the equivalent or the apical German chocolate brand to my software talk. And these are 4 vegan chocolates. So just final product placement. I hope I get a free supply from Ritter Sport now. So here we go. Culinary challenge.
All right. I didn't realize we had vegan chocolate squares. Now we do. So apparently come in dark and white chocolate. So very, very cool. Hey, thanks for being on the show, everybody. If it's Friday, it's Disrupt TV. And thank you. Catch you every Friday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. And of course, we're happy to have you all here. So, all right.
Stay healthy.